marshmallows, maybe making s'mores. So we have a very special panel here. We have the Solicitors General of Iowa and Ohio, and their bios are on the website. You can look at them there. And I'm just going to dive straight in by opening with the question that I closed with, which is, are we doing too much? Are we putting too much onto the courts? Are we pressuring them to solve issues that the legislature should be solving? And specifically, are we putting too much onto the federal courts? And Eric, I'm going to ask you to go first.
Sure. I think it's not necessarily that we're asking the courts to do too much, although I guess the question is who we is. But when it comes to the states, a lot of what we're doing is asking them to reallocate who's doing what away from agencies that have not been empowered by Congress to do what they're doing to Congress itself to either authorize the agencies or to do it themselves. And I think in that limited role, you know, there are tools in place that Congress has enacted that give the states the ability to make those challenges. I think that's normally pretty good. I do think that when it comes to broadly enacting social policies, there's a tendency to conflate, especially, but not uniquely among non-lawyers, like what is the best policy with what a court is actually able to do. And
so can you give me an example of that?
Sure. I think there was just a decision that came out of the Fifth Circuit, which is Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana, relating to Texas's foster care agencies. And it's not an area in which I'm expert, but I was reading the opinion, and it sounded like the district court was really seeing itself as the superintendent of foster care policy for the state of Texas. And no matter how qualified or intelligent that judge is, that's just not what the role of a judge is. And so 15 years after that judge took on that role, the Fifth Circuit vacated or reversed and reassigned to a different judge to basically say, at some point, this has to have a resolution. There's not just an open-ended mandate to effectuate the policies that you think are right, even whether or not they're right. It's just not something that is the proper role of the courts. And I think when you're appointed to life tenure, there might be a tendency to think that I can do not very much wrong, and that sometimes can lead judges away from the humility that helps making being a judge the best thing that they could be.
No, we are not asking courts to do too much. The state of Ohio.
Robust response. I like that.
The state of Ohio is asking courts to respect and to, in many ways, serve as the physician for an out of joint separation of powers in this country. When I go to court asking for relief, it is because over a long period of disrepair and decline and desuetude, we have allowed our country to abandon many of its fundamental tenets. When we think about what it is that we want from our courts and why judicial independence is so important, why the separation of powers is so important, it makes me actually think of a Bible verse. And before you are too worried, it's from the part that we both agree on.
Thank God.
My Jewish friend here. Leviticus 19:15 says, "Do not pervert justice by showing partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great. Instead, do justice to your neighbors." Why do you have an independent judiciary? It's because of the insight that crowds don't always, through the democratic process, do a good job of adjudging right and wrong and what is just or not. And so I think when the states are going to court today, what we're mostly asking them to do is to fulfill their role, their discharge, and to put back into place the disjointed separation of powers that we see at the federal level.
Are there places where you feel like things are better? Where, let me say this in a different way. Where are things better handled in state court, and where are they better handled in federal court? How do you think about separating those issues, which doesn't have to be the way the courts currently do, but where, because you guys think about that all the time, I would imagine, is what the right venue for various questions are. So how do you think about that problem, and how should we be separating that?
Yeah, I think when you to my colleague's excellent insight that social policy belongs in the legislative branch. Actually, that's where the wisdom of crowds is very helpful. When you're prescribing rules that will apply prospectively about how we live together, that's what the police powers are for. That's why you have in Ohio, Iowa, top two Midwestern states.
Especially with three vowels.
Right, yeah, so we look at that and we say, the General Assembly is actually quite good at that role. It's well-equipped. Those people in our state legislature, they live with their communities. It's a job with a salary. It's technically full-time, but it's not really enough to support a family, especially if you live like 3 hours away from Columbus. So most of these people live and work and abide by the rules that they create. That's excellent. What courts are not good at is setting those kinds of prospective rules. What they're good at doing is looking backwards and judging between cases and controversies, parties that have a concrete dispute about how that law cashes out in a given case. And because it is indeed case by case, the evidentiary deep dive that a trial system is, in fact, the best devised system of which I am aware to suss out the truth for limited, epistemically confined human beings like us, the trial system is the best system for that. Courts shouldn't be making social policy because courts are essentially backward-looking institutions. Legislatures should be making social policy because they're the ones who can peer out into the future and actually see what it will look like if that rule versus a different rule becomes the law.
And change it, right? I mean, a court also seems to me, again, from a layman's perspective, a very ponderous way to solve a social problem. On the one hand, yes, you can have one judge making decisions, but on the other hand, it's actually, once a decision has been made by a higher court, it's then quite a procedure to change it. And, you know, legislation's not easy, but maybe easier than working your way up through seven layers of appeal. So I was last night, because I'm an incredibly glamorous person with an incredibly glamorous job, there I was sitting in my chair at 10 p.m., and as one does, reading the amicus briefs in U.S. v. Scrimeti. Mm-hmm. This strikes me as some of what you are saying, right? It is the plaintiffs asking a court to decide a contentious social issue rather than the legislature.
Yeah, I think it's often, or it's even worse than that in this case, because we're dealing with very unsettled experimental science. This case, for those of you that aren't familiar, is about 25 states, half the states, have passed laws that prohibit permanent sex change treatments for children. And activists across the country, and in some cases joined by the Biden-Harris Department of Justice, have sued those states seeking to have those laws, enforcement of those laws enjoined as unconstitutional. So to put in perspective some of the specific things that these laws address, cross-sex hormones, permanent drugs that would lead to inability to have sex for adults, and then of course there's surgeries for minors. And there are a few different one of these cases. The one in question here came out of Tennessee and in the Sixth Circuit where Ohio is. I'm in the Eighth Circuit, not quite as glamorous, but better corn. And
also
so
very good pie, I find, in Iowa.
Excellent pie. We have a wonderful Mennonite population and the farmer's market every week. And let me just also say, if you're interested in working in Iowa, we are always hiring. So please, like, always feel free to reach out. But going back to Scrimeti, which is the name of Tennessee's attorney general, they were sued. They went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And basically, their argument is that, one, their law does not need to face heightened scrutiny because they're not discriminating on any protected class basis. If you're a boy or a girl, you're not able to access this permanent life-altering treatment under Tennessee law. Treatments that have not yet gone through all of the full experimentation and process they should. And that this law is rational, has a rational basis. And nothing in the Tennessee law at issue here says that a consenting adult can or can't do anything. I know there's a lot of controversy in the media now. I believe Vice President Harris, when she was running last time, wanted to let detained illegal aliens in prison get sex change treatments and in an ACLU.
Yes, the ACLU asked her if she would do that, and she said yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of very contentious side issues, but here the question is, the science is not settled, no matter what the activists say, and the state is saying, hold up, until we understand that this is actually safe and beneficial for kids, we don't think this is right. And people sued and are asking the courts to make a final decision. And it's not clear to me at all why they think that, one, the courts will agree with them, and so far, almost uniformly, they haven't. And I think that's an excellent example of, across the board, judges with very different demeanors and approaches to the law have come to the same result, which is that a state can ban an experimental treatment for children that might have permanent life impacts. And I'm hoping that the Supreme Court is going to also leave that question to the states to decide.
So, I mean, here is where I see a little bit of tension, although I think this tension may be entirely self-interested, but bear with me. So, I mean, I take your point that trials are actually a really good place to get information. And for me, the reason I'm reading these amicus briefs is that this court, this trial, has been fantastic for journalists who write about this issue, of whom I am one. Because getting information out of these organizations has been extremely difficult, and Alabama especially has just gone postal on some of these groups and is putting out a lot of briefs, and that's, I think, good for the public discourse. And yet at the same time, I sort of don't want this case to exist, because I agree with you that this is a question for the states to legislate, and that we shouldn't, the suit should never have been brought. It should have been shot down earlier, because these are just the sorts of questions that should be handled by the legislature. Is that even a tension, or am I making
it? At the risk of jumping in, I just also really want to highlight, when we're talking about the importance of an independent judiciary, that the Alabama case in particular is an egregious example, based, again, on just the allegations and what the court has said, of these activist groups trying to effectively gerrymander their way out of the judge they got.
Can you elaborate on that just a little bit?
So they filed their lawsuit. They got assigned a judge that they thought would not be sympathetic because he was appointed by President Trump, and basically tried to file another complaint and get in front of a different judge and basically avoid the judge that they had been assigned, all to avoid this one specific judge in a way that, at least according to the show cause order, I believe, some people have said maybe unethical, and I think certainly reflects poor judgment. But in that case, they did not get out from that judge's purview. And then the judge granted them relief. He was reversed on appeal, but they worked so hard to avoid what they were sure was going to be an unfair judge, who then gave them a hearing, agreed with them, gave them the relief they saw, and then in the end, like every other court to look at the issue, they lost. And now a lot of this discovery, this explosive discovery, is coming out of that litigation because, you know, they're stuck in court, and they sued, and now they have to deal with the consequences. But sorry.
Yeah, well, I that story has been paralleled in state court in Ohio, actually. Because Tennessee was a little ahead of Ohio in adopting a law that protected children in this way from permanent life-altering surgeries, cross-sex hormones, puberty blockers, the effects of which are deeply uncertain, the benefits of which are certainly unclear, and the risks and downsides are something that can be evidence-based. They sued in state court, and of course they forum shopped, the ACLU in this instance representing a pair of plaintiffs, to find a blue county where judges are elected by a very sympathetic electorate. And again, they prevailed at the preliminary injunction stage. The law was set on ice statewide over our objection. My attorney general said, we're going to court about this. We're going to do fact-based discovery. We held a 5-day trial on the merits. We had expert testimony. We brought in some of the same evidence that Alabama saw. And this judge in a blue county, at the end of that trial, reversed himself, let the law go into effect, and now that law is in effect in protecting children in the state of Ohio while it's on appeal in the state court system. And so what's particularly galling me about the U.S. versus Scrimeti case is I actually think that there are some poor motives. At least there's enough evidence to give rise to a suspicion of the motives here. If you're the president of the United States, You can go to Congress and say, you know what, I think there should be a one-size-fits-all legislative rule with respect to transgender issues. And setting aside all the potential other federalism, separation of powers, First Amendment issues that might be involved in that, there is a channel in the Constitution for nationwide solutions, one that is accountable to the people and in which the states have, through their senators and representatives, a way to have input. And they didn't do that. They went to the court system. Why? Is it perhaps that they suspect that the court system will say, hey, wait a minute, we don't want to be involved in that issue? And maybe they suspect that in certain quarters, that will discredit those courts in the eyes of the public. Perhaps this lawsuit isn't so much about creating a nationwide rule where I think their prospects of success, God willing, are very low at the US Supreme Court. Perhaps it's more of a battering ram against the independence of that judiciary to basically throw, as ancient siege engines would, you know, like diseased animals into the courtyard of the people that you're attacking, right? Let's put a hot button social issue on the court's docket again and again and again until half the country thinks that even if it just simply applies the law, the headlines that will be written about it is law, Supreme Court is against transgender youth. That's going to be the headline no matter how the court rules, if it rules in favor of democracy.
So let me circle this back then to the larger theme that we were discussing in our last panel. And do you see other cases where you think that is happening? I mean, this the Scrimeti and these issues around transgender kids, I think, are the most toxic issue to me looking at it from the media. But you guys are looking at it as lawyers. You are seeing both, not just the cases that have political controversy, but the cases that have big kind of lasting legal implications for all sorts of things that percolate out. So where else do you see cases where, do you, I shouldn't say where else, do you see cases elsewhere where it feels like it's well poisoning? It is an attempt not so much to get a result, but to undermine the legitimacy of the institution from which you are seeking the result.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one example that immediately comes to mind is the fact that not only Alabama, but Virginia has been sued over maintaining their voter rolls, just the basic task of ensuring that people who have moved have up-to-date information. People who are not citizens don't have to, you know, have to worry about someone voting in their name. And what could possibly be the reason for that? Well, either you want non-citizens to vote, you want non-residents who have moved out of state to vote. I don't think that's it. Maybe it's just to churn up some mud and to put additional pressure on the judiciary. I mean, as an officer of a state government, I work for the Attorney General, I get to bring lawsuits sometimes and be the lawyer representing the state. I do think a little bit about you know, what kind of pressure this is going to place on our institutions. And I think one of the things that has lacked in our political discourse is the resource that institutions constitute. They are a public good. Maybe I'm too much of a UChicago person here right now, law and economics, but these
as a graduate of UChicago, I approve.
And this is an all UChicago panel at this particular moment, so look at that.
All the best.
Freedom of thought, freedom of speech, and cold winters. And I'll say this, though, the resource that our institutions, that they're an inheritance for us. And if you assail them, if you tear them down, it's not so very easy to rebuild alternative institutions. Look at the right. I mean, people on the conservative side of the aisle have been trying their best to build a parallel set of institutions, as many institutions have been, in their judgment, captured by an ideological viewpoint. And it's not an easy thing to do. There are a few examples, like the Federalist Society, where I think it's very effective to build an alternative ecosystem. But that is no substitute for the Constitution's judicial power residing in a Supreme Court that isn't itself a political football that descends into the maw of negative partisanship every election cycle.
And sort of also just thinking about how these lawsuits work, it's not infrequent that someone sues the state. They often choose the highest profile statewide officer to be named as the defendant in the lawsuit. Before we actually get served with the lawsuit, the fundraising email goes out. Look at this good thing we're doing, suing the evil Republicans in the state. And then, you know, we eventually, hopefully, often win the lawsuit. And then, you know, the same people sue us again and send out another fundraising email. And I think that that's not by any means all of these groups, but, you know, maybe this is my Inner U Chicago coming out. How much money can be donated to groups that just keep suing, and you know, maybe they get a sugar high of a preliminary injunction and then it gets vacated. And I guess then they get more donations and they can do it again. And all I can say is I have a deep and abiding affection for a lot of the activist groups in our state. In the last year, we defended successfully our heartbeat abortion law, our law removing inappropriate books from schools. All these wins wouldn't be possible without the activist groups that sue us and tee it up for appellate courts to create binding precedent going forward. And they're my best partners.
I think we've all been there. It's midnight. You're a little hungry. You just want to go get a preliminary injunction.
Yeah.
Sit down in front of a Netflix for a little while.
If you want it at midnight, you have to call the court and tell them it's an emergency motion. You got to file it, you know, before 5 p.m.
I mean, do you see things getting worse or better on this front? When you look at your own states, your own practice,
I would say the frenetic pace and the extreme noise. I root for the Ohio State University. If you've ever been to the Horseshoe, it's a great experience. It's very loud. Whenever you're sort of like right on the goal line, the fever pitch noise of the crowd, that sort of, I feel like that's sort of the political moment that a lot of people feel that they're living in, where you're right on the goal line. From my perspective, it's those who want to permanently erode constitutional norms on the goal line of someone who says maybe we should not permanently erode constitutional norms and fending them off after failed attempt at a pass again and again. But we're close, right? And that's why it feels like things are such high stakes. If you think you're about to win forever, if you think that maybe you're about to lose forever, and you can decide for yourself which side you think you might be on, but most of America feels like they're on one of those two sides at this particular moment, it's dark, right? Turns out, though, Democratic political life together is not a football game. It's not one where it ends. You actually have to go and be friends and neighbors with each other afterward. And so I think de-escalation here is only possible if you start to re-enable the judiciary, the legislative branch, the executive branch at the federal level, and then the division between state and federal authority. Those are the shock absorbers for that frenetic energy.
Is part of this that everything is nationalized now? This is a problem for us in the media, where nothing's a local story, everything is a national story. And so I would assume that many of the groups in your state are getting donations from people who did not know those groups existed 10 or 15 years ago. And that also the cases then end up on social media in a way that they would not have 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. And is that a problem? Is it a benefit because it is creating opportunities for you to win cases?
Yeah, I think, I guess a couple points there. One is, I find that often, more often than not, when we're litigating against someone, even when it gets pretty heated, the opposing counsel tends to be fine. You know, there's not the same acrimony there as, you know, maybe in the media, maybe even with comment from opposing counsel, but you know, when you're actually in the courtroom or leading up to court, for the most part, things work smoothly. And I am always interested to see if some of the negative polarization ma that you were describing bleeds over from the press and the media that really turn up the temperature on some of these cases into the courtroom. And I think for the most part it doesn't, but you know, there's always a worry. You know, there's a saying about a judge, and if I were to hear this about a judge that I liked and respected, I probably wouldn't love it, but sometimes the judges might care a lot about what people think, and I think that this was expressed. There was that old phrase, the greenhouse effect, not about climate change, but about the old New York Times reporter, Linda Greenhouse.
Oh, gosh.
And the idea is that some judges cared a lot what she wrote in the New York Times. And I think back to before I was born, but I've seen the headline. I think it was an early Eighth Amendment case with Justice Thomas. And she wrote a headline, you know, the Supreme Court's new youngest and cruelest justice. And it did not seem to shake him at all. And I think that, you know, she probably picked on him, but that wasn't the target of her pen because she didn't think that that would affect what he would do. And I think part of this is judges that want to be, you know, in polite society, they want to be out with their friends, especially in some of these cities that may be trend a little more liberal. They don't want the front page of, you know, nationwide publications like the Des Moines Register saying they're a bigot. I mean, and I think that that is a tool that the media, who tends to often have a view on a given case, knows that they can use to their advantage to keep that temperature turned up.
And we are always completely objective. I don't know what you were talking about.
Yeah.
Just totally disinterested, fighting for justice and liberty across the land. What issues are people not talking about at the state level that they should be talking more about outside of your states?
Well, it's tough because a lot of the issues that we are dealing with end up being talked about a lot. But I think that maybe one sort of hovering, overarching issue is just like, what are these agencies doing? And like one example of that, and this has gotten a lot of attention, although maybe not as much as it should have, the Biden administration was working on a third attempt at loan forgiveness after the Supreme Court twice told them yes. not to.
And the first, you don't succeed.
Yeah, this third attempt, they had, in the second attempt, some money went out the door before the preliminary injunctions saying this is illegal, you can't do it, happened. And the courts did not order them to claw that money back. So the lesson that the Biden-Harris administration learned was, we need to plan a blitzkrieg, and we need to make sure that this loan forgiveness goes into effect, and that money gets out the door before a court is able to like wake up and issue an injunction. And they were trying to make sure that hundreds of billions of dollars got out the door within 72 hours, specifically to avoid judicial review. I think that more and more creative attempts to violate norms, ignore Supreme Court precedents by the current administration, it's something that now is just happening so frequently. And there are so many errors in the rules that they're rushing out to avoid potentially getting overturned. In the second loan forgiveness, there was a whole section about how this would only cost $150 billion because of the successful case that they won at the Supreme Court in Nebraska against the United States, which was their loss in the first case. They had issued before they wrote the rule for the second case, and they just didn't update it. So like each time, they have these errors in these rules. They know they're there. These are hundreds of billions of dollars. They're trying to get it out in an election year. And people are kind of like, well, that's not that interesting because, you know, we can focus on, you know, the guy we really don't like as much. And no one wants to talk about the president at all because he's not even running. So I think that's a real problem, is these agencies are really getting aggressive, kind of because maybe they don't think that they're going to have that long to be aggressive. And what we learned in the Trump administration is once a rule, even an illegal rule, goes into effect, it takes a legal process to undo the illegal rule, which is also, I think, you know, really going to slow things up if the situation changes in trying to right the ship.
Yeah, a couple things come to mind. So just on the topic of judicial independence more broadly, I think you can categorize the types of threats to judicial independence into three basic camps. There are political threats, there are cultural threats, and then there are the threats from within. The political threats are the ones we've mostly been discussing tonight. One branch of government says, hey, we're going to put pressure on the courts, we're going to go after them. The cultural threat, I think that comes from the culture of many institutions that are behaving like battering rams against the reputations of individual members of the courts, both at confirmation and then relentlessly after confirmation. The third threat is when judges brush back from the plate themselves, doing something that they're ill-equipped to do, which is predict the political consequences and fallout of ruling without fear or favor. And the reason that you want an independent judiciary is that a judiciary that is lifetime appointed, you can't change their pay, they have tenure protection with a strong check, but only for impeachment for bad behavior, is that that's the one place where you're pretty much guaranteed you're not going to have ordinary agency capture problems, issues where the special interest groups sort of take control of an agency and have them turn the opposite of square corners, squiggly, strange, roundabout corners.
One last quick point on that. The New York Times does like an end of term roundup and they list the important cases, all sorts of issues, but just like if you click on the arrow to expand, one of the like three bullet points is a public relations survey of what the public thinks of the decision. And to think that, you know, it's like 73-27. Let me tell you, there is no case at the Supreme Court in which 100% of people have an opinion. There is almost no case in which most people have an informed opinion, because these are, you know, like, you want to tell me that 64% of the American public thinks that Jarchese finding a right to, like, you know, go to trial instead of an administrative law judge? Like, good luck. But that's how it's presented.
I have been really impressed by the number of people on Twitter who turned out to be experts on Chevron deference. I had no idea.
Yeah. And the only expertise on Chevron I have is when I go to the gas station. And in Iowa, it's Casey's, the great breakfast pizza.
I'm not going to make the same critical error I did before and not leave time for Q&A, but let me ask you the final question, which is, what are the best and worst things about being a Solicitor General that no one knows about?
Well, let me just make this pitch. I see a lot of young lawyers in the room. My fellow last year, who's now at Williams & Connolly, had two Iowa Supreme Court arguments, and she would have had an Eighth Circuit argument if she wasn't practice barred. We have so many arguments on important, high-profile cases. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of discovery, so you won't be able to like do a lot of document review. Although maybe, you know, in the case of Alabama, it sounds like they had that there. But there are so many opportunities to go out to serve the people of the state. I grew up in Connecticut. I'm an Iowan by choice. I love living in a state where I can defend the people, where I have a court system. You know, I'm 50-50 at the Iowa Supreme Court. I don't win every time, but it's a legitimate court. They apply the law, and sometimes they agree with me, and sometimes they might get it wrong. But they're doing an amazing job. And I mean, some of this attacks on the legitimacy of the court trickles down. We have one justice voted to uphold a state law protecting fetal heartbeat in the state of Iowa. And there is a concerted campaign to get him non-retained on the basis of a substantive vote in a case. And the only reason they're just targeting him is he's the only one up for retention that voted what they would say is the wrong way. I think that kind of attack on the judiciary, trying to undermine its legitimacy, which is what a lot of the posts and articles about this are doing, they say he voted wrong on one case, so you need to make sure he doesn't even have a job, that he can't be a judge anymore.
What does that do to your practice? When you are up in front of these, do you worry about that? Do you worry about this is going to make cases go the wrong way for you?
You know, so far in Iowa, I don't think that they have changed their votes on this basis. But it is something that I worry about, and not just for state judges with retention elections. I worry about federal judges who have lifetime tenure and no backbone. And I remember, we went to UChicago for law school. There are people with tenure there. And, you know, when bad stuff is happening on campus about free speech or any of these things that they're passionate about, behind closed doors, they know I'm conservative, right? They'll say, you're so, like, get out there, like, defend, you know, whatever. And the second it comes to defending any of this in public, you know, it turns out life tenure doesn't come with a steel spine. And I see the same problem with the judiciary, and I just hope that whoever is picking judges is picking judges that care more about getting the law right than they do about being popular. I think that is the key insight into what it takes to be a good judge of any kind, but especially federal judge. And, you know, to me, it's just mind-boggling that you could have life tenure and not have courage. I was worried when I was in law school and I was doing some conservative stuff, I was worried they were going to, like, slimy and I wouldn't be able to get a job at all, right? And I still did it, and I was, you know, not a life-tenured federal judge, so.
Yeah. Last word.
Well, it's a great job being a Solicitor General. The Chief Judge Sutton says it's still his favorite job that he's had. He's said that publicly and shared it to me several times. And, you know, as far as the fellowship goes, the Simon Karas Fellowship in Ohio, I see my former fellow there. He argued four times, including once at the Sixth Circuit, twice at the Ohio Supreme Court, and once in an Intermediate Court of Appeals. And so...
Getting up to stand up
in court and be able to say, this is Elliot Geiser on behalf of the state of Ohio, where I was born and raised, the state that raised me, made who I am, to be able to give back to them in some meaningful way by trying my best to provide this piece of sovereignty in our constitutional fabric that has the best representation that it could have. It's the best job. And to Eric's point about needing rebar in your spine. I think we should select for that when we're thinking about who should run for state court judges, who should be appointed to the federal judiciary. Are you able to live up to the idea that you will not be partial to the poor and you will not show favoritism to the great? If you can do that, then I think maybe the only thing better than being the top advocate for a state in appellate court might be being a judge who has that kind of fortitude, planted their feet in the ground the way that they should.
Well, I think we have two candidates here on stage, so
I'm gonna throw this open to the audience for Q&A, if we have...
Hi, I just wanna actually to ask a question based on the last two comments. You posited that perhaps it's not a good idea for the judges to be voted out of office based on their decisions. Of course, Iowa had three justices voted out of office when they found it right of gay marriage. And so I just wonder, is it really such a bad idea to have justices, so long as they do have that spine of steel, to have that check on them, either through retention elections or through partisan elections? Now, my personal, my state usually has retention elections, and on principle, I always vote no, because I don't like communist elections when there's only one candidate, so even if I like the judge. But if you're actually taking their decision into account, is it really such a bad idea to have the judges accountable to the public? And if they have a spine of steel, they should be willing to lose their job if they think they made a right decision.
Well, I'll say this. I think a judicial philosophy is a good basis on which to vote for or against a candidate for judicial office. And states in the federal system are different. One of the reasons you need life tenure and you need an independent judiciary of a certain kind at the federal level is that that institution will mediate disputes between the states and between the states and the federal government. And so I think that you have a heightened concern there. Now, as far as state court elections go, I think democracy is the worst form of judicial selection except for all the other ones. And when you see in many of my fellow states a system like, I think they call it the Missouri Plan, does...
It's VF.
Yeah, it does the state of Missouri's name dirty to call that the Missouri Plan. But the idea that you have basically the local bar, which is very politically one-sided, constrain the governor's appointment to just a few people that they find to be palatable, and, you know, it's like four flavors of activist judge. That system is worse than having what Ohio has now, which, you know, this is the second election that we've had where you have partisan ID attached as information for the voters among the different justices who are running.
I guess just super quick, I think that a judge should rule the right way without fear for losing his or her job. I think that is what their job is. I think there's a difference when the attempt to non-retain a judge is based on reasons and rationales outside of what the system itself contemplates. And so if we had partisan elections, I would probably vote for the judge to which I had, that I thought was going to apply the law best. And if there was a judge that I thought had a judicial philosophy that was inimical to interpreting the Constitution and the state laws in a way to their oath, I would vote against retaining that judge, even if there were no ethical violations or anything like that. And maybe that's ultimately what the people saying non-retain are trying to argue, but that's not what they're arguing. And, you know, I just try to take people where they are, and where they are seems to be, we don't like this one correct decision, so we want to non-retain you, and I just don't find that very persuasive.
We have another question from the audience.
Gene Meyer. I wondered on the Skrimecki case, I heard somebody say, I don't know the details, that the argument, the one of the arguments the other way was, well, parent, you know, this is parent, parents are the ones making the decisions about what their children should do. And I will admit I wonder about some of the people who are making that argument, whether they would apply that in other situations. But nonetheless, it's a perfectly it's a perfectly clear argument. Have that argument been made? What do you make of that?
Yeah, so that argument is live in the Ohio state court case. And so what we've said in our filings, what I said in argument in the Intermediate Court of Appeals last month was that parents do have rights to direct in general the upbringing, care, education, religious impulses of their children. But that's not an absolute right, and it has to be defined not at the perch of the ladder of abstraction, but with some measure of specificity. And then the Glucksberg test applies, where you need to look not only to whether or not you can contemplate a system of ordered liberty without such a right to a certain type of medical treatment, but also whether there's a deeply rooted history and tradition of such a parental right. And there is no deeply rooted history and tradition of parents doing either sex change surgeries for minors or them doing getting access to having a positive right to a type of medical treatment that the state has generally proscribed. And I think the positive-negative liberty split is actually quite important here. It's one thing to say, I think that it violates my rights of conscience for me or my child to take this type of medical treatment that is generally required of those who would attend, you know, a school, for example. It's quite another thing to say, I have an affirmative right to a doctor giving me this type of treatment, even if the state has said it's not generally safe or effective for children. And there is no history or tradition of that latter component. And so the rights of parents over children are not absolute, and I don't think anyone would argue for them to be. And so the question is, where do we draw that line? And the line has to be looked at in terms of ordered liberty deeply rooted in the history and tradition of our common law and our Anglo-American legal tradition.
Can I ask a follow-up? We've had situations where states on both sides of this, we've had California saying, if you can get your kid here, we'll terminate your spouse's parental rights. I think that did not ultimately pass, but it was being considered. And we've had Texas saying, we're going to sick CPS on you if you take your child out of state in order to get treatments that we have deemed to be illegal. How should states handle those questions of, I'm gonna spirit my kids somewhere else in order to either do or not do the treatment that I think is best for them?
So I think with a lot of these cases, you get these highly contrived scenarios that focus on one question, but there is actually a rich history and tradition of the type of rights and responsibilities that, for example, if you have two parents that disagree about what to do with a child relating to a healthcare decision, how to handle that, and run away to another state to get medical treatment is not in that tradition. And so, like, I understand that, you know, or, you know, on the other hand, I know that there's been some reporting about what Texas is doing, but, like, ultimately, the question here is not about kids getting permanent life-altering treatment. There's a long history of how the United States deals with parental rights over their children, and that gives you the answer the vast, vast majority of the time. And when it comes to states passing, like California, laws that, you know, or I guess not passing in this case, laws that seem very much out of the mainstream, that sort of try to take something out of that long history, like, we've been a country for hundreds of years, but our legal tradition goes back even further. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find a point at any point in time, one where, like, one parent can, like, effectively kidnap the child from the other parent to undergo medical treatment. Like, and so no matter that it happens to be the trans issue, which is highly controversial, I don't think that creates an exception to just, like, let's treat this the way we've always treated this type of dispute.
We have another question, it looks like, over there.
Tim Rosenberger, also Ohio. It seems like a lot of the pressure and energy around state court races comes from the reality that in the last several years, they decide redistricting cases, they decide which votes are going to be counted, they decide how those votes are going to be counted. you have these sort of bizarre think pieces like, whoever wins this Wisconsin Supreme Court seat will determine who the next president is. How do we sort of take that pressure off of our state courts? Should we encourage them to be more like the U.S. Supreme Court, where they just say, you know, fight it out, whoever happens to be able to stuff the ballots in will be fine, we're not getting involved? Or is there some way to sort of insulate them or muscle them up so there's less of this national politicization on the state court races?
I think it's tough to answer that question in a truly comprehensive way, because at some level, when you have a culture at odds with itself, which is what we find ourselves experiencing in the United States, it becomes challenging to say, well, there's going to be no place in which that pressure comes to bear. I think state courts are maybe second only to federal courts, the worst place to be the outlet for all of that. General assemblies and legislatures seem to be much better positioned to do it. And one thing that general assemblies and state legislatures can do is they can act to define some of the jurisdiction of their state courts. You know, the Ohio Supreme Court has original jurisdiction in mandamus over many election disputes. In fact, Mark Elias sued over our drop boxes rule last week, another in the long line of zero Mark Elias, you know, long number on my side of the column. Because the Ohio Supreme Court has been given the authority to do that. You need an answer, you need an answer quickly, and it's usually a question of pure law, and in that particular instance, they gave us precisely the answer. Now we can run our election going forward. And without having like multiple lawsuits in multiple courts of common pleas filtering up and disrupting the entirety of our system, I think that kind of model can be something that the Brandeisian laboratories for experimentation in the states could maybe give us some insight on.
Yeah, to go to back to the UChicago thing, we only had one F word, it was fair. and I just think, especially with election law, so many people have such strong views on like what is fair, and those are often very removed from what is the law. And some of the problems arise when people want something that they say is needed or necessary that isn't the law as written. And I think one place where courts maybe find themselves in hot water is when these very sympathetic plaintiffs and organizations are bringing these claims that ask to violate the law, and they go along with it. And that doesn't happen super frequently. I think that became a really acute issue during COVID for a lot of what seemed like, you know, exigent circumstances at the time. But, you know, as with all things, you know, there's a saying, bad facts make bad law. Same with good plaintiffs, right? You know, you might get a really sympathetic person, and, you know, we're all Americans, we love voting. You know, I came from Chicago before Iowa. You vote early and often, right? You vote as many times as you can. And
get the dead relatives out.
Yeah.
Make it a party.
Yeah. And so, like, I understand the empathy there, but, you know, maybe to put myself on the other side from some extremely qualified, smart people, like, I don't think empathy is the most important thing in, like, applying laws. I think, you know, being able to, you know, read the law as written is, which, you know, dovetails nicely into one of the Federalist Society's three tenets. And I just think that in election law, that's one area where some folks have really gone awry.
We are getting the hook, it looks like. Thank you so much for an amazing panel. Really a pleasure.
Thank you all for staying late into the night. We are a little over. If you haven't already checked the QR code at the bar, that will actually take you to one of the best Substacks on cocktail mixology. I encourage it.
High endorse.
That too. And I do want to thank our fantastic moderator, Megan, and our fireside chat, and thank you all for joining us for a really just a fantastic program. We're adjourned.